This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 351 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And guess what, gang? We've got a fantastic guest today. Talking records, vinyl, collectibles, music, and more, Mr. Brian Baker. Now, Brian, as you probably know, he's spent time in heaps of bands that we love and collect. Bands like Bad Religion, Minor Threat, Fake Names, Dag Nasty, The Meat Men, Beach Rats, and lots more. So there is a lot to cover. Today we talk to Brian about the early days, joining Minor Threat, the adventures of touring as a teenager, making the first Minor Threat EP, the DIY assembly at Discord House, joining the Meat Men, Bad Religion, his records with the Beach Rats, Fake Names, and lots more. Now, Brian is very funny, very engaging, and of course, grateful for his amazing career, an absolute gem of a guy. And I think everyone, punk rock fan or not, will enjoy this conversation. And hey, speaking of enjoying this conversation, there is more of it up at patreon.com/vinylguide. An extended version of this interview, it's commercial free, it's high resolution for you audiophiles, and I do that kind of thing with just about all our Vinyl Guide episodes. Podcasts pretty much make fuck all money, so this is how I keep it going. If you like this podcast, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/vinylguide. $5 or $10 a month or whatever you could afford goes a long way to help support this show. Join us up at patreon.com/vinylguide and get all the extras. And finally, if you're new to this podcast, we have over 300 other episodes and interviews talking to musicians about records, vinyl collecting, music anecdotes, factoids, and more, all available for free through any podcast app. Just simply subscribe or follow and you could listen to the likes of Henry Rollins, Vinyl Guide, Episode 100, Ian MacKay, Discord, Minor Threat, and Fugazi, Episodes 280 and 281, Saturday Night Live in Portlandia, Punk Fan, Fred Armisen, Episode 289, Rick Nielsen of Cheap Trick, Vinyl Guide, Episode 266, Eamon Sandwith of The Chats, Episode 256 of The Vinyl Guide, and heaps more. Subscribe to The Vinyl Guide in your podcast app, download, listen, and enjoy. Alrighty, enough of the upfronts. Let's get on to our chit chat with Mr. Brian Baker.
Nate.
Mr. Brian Baker, how are you?
I'm good. I'm trying to let you see me because I know this is audio only, but it's just better.
Yeah. You get that, you know.
It's important, I think.
Visual cues.
Yeah.
First off, thank you very much for accommodating my my early hour here in Sydney. I know this is a time you typically don't do these, and I do appreciate the flexibility.
I like talking about myself, and I'll do it any time of the day.
You'll always make time.
No, it's no problem at all, Nate. I'm a fan.
Oh, excellent. Well, thank you very much. It sounds like you're familiar with the show. Are you a bit of a record collector? Do you have a record collection?
You know, sadly, I grew up as a record collector. And I think like so many of us, I had to sell them off basically to keep my dream of being a musician alive. And I had a lot of, well, I had every early hardcore record, really, because I was there when they came out. So, but I didn't have to start selling them until the early 90s. So at least I did get real money for my Cough Cool, and I got real money for my Necros, you know, test pressing. And, you know, but compared to now, of course, it's change. But, you know, they served a purpose. And I really wish that I had not had to do that. But having done that, I haven't decided to go back and rebuy them. It just kind of took the whole, when you sell 100 disc Damned collection, it's really hard to go back, you know?
But at least it sounds like they played a role in your, you know, a stopgap perhaps to get you from one phase of your career to another.
Well, certainly. And also just the, I mean, I loved collecting the records, especially the Damn collection, because, I mean, Henry Rollins always had a better collection than I did. And of course, now it's just ridiculous what he has. But I remember having three different colors of Don't Cry Wolf. Like, do you have the Swedish one that's yellow? You know, that sort of thing. And it was just, and everything was cheap. So it wasn't about flexing. It was just about, oh my God, you know, Skip Groff's got all three. I got three love songs. What colors? Well, he's got a red, he's got a blue, and you take the bus to Rockville, Maryland. It's just, that was great.
Yeah.
And being fortunate enough as a teenager to travel to other cities. And then there's the record store thing. And I mean, so many people in this age group can identify with that. And I'm not going to bemoan the lack of that. I mean, things are just different now. Mm-hmm. But it was a big part, you know, the going to a record store, not buying anything in Raleigh, North Carolina, was cooler than going to the grocery store.
Do you still go to record stores these days?
Well, I live in Asbury Park, New Jersey now. And we had when I moved here, there was a great record store called Holdfast that my friend Joe owned. And it's gone now. He developed an incredible online business, and he specializes in Jamaican music. And then when COVID hit, you know, it just, I mean, the Asbury Park is sort of the new Williamsburg, to give it some perspective. Like, it's cool now, so everything's expensive. And so he just went online. So that was the only record store I had that I went to all the time. But there's really nothing. I'm sure that there's something around me in a town that I just don't know, because also I'm 57. You know, I don't hear what's going on as quickly as other people. You know, if it's not on Twitter, I don't really know what.
Have you kept any of the collectibles from your from the early years?
I have stuff that I would play it on. But I don't have all of it. Like, I don't have a first pressing Cousin sleeve in my eyes. And I know where there is one, but I don't want to pay $2,000 for it just to complete it. I mean, I have a non-Cousins first pressing in my eyes. Mm-hmm. I don't have everything, but I have a representation. Let's put it this way. When I went to, I was looking at what I had, and I realized that I didn't have a red first Minor Threat single. Like, I have a blue and a yellow, and I was looking at a guy online who had a site that was just about the Minor Threat discography, and I was like, you know, learning, like, I mean, I was on them, but I didn't know what order they came out in or what kind of rarity it was. But the next time I was at Discord House visiting, I asked Ian, I was like, hey, you got a red single I can have? And he's like, of course. And we go up to a kind of a cool storage room. Like, they have, it's a different place now, but at the time it was one of the bedrooms. And he just pulls one out, and it is perfect. It is perfect, untouched, unplayed. It still smells like the print shop. It's just amazing. And I'm like, God, that was so nice of him to do that for me. But also I just treasure it. That's like, it can't get played. You know, it was really cool that he did that. And the only thing I have that's of any real value is I have a silkscreened out-of-step test pressing. Oh. And I only have that because I gave it to my dad probably when it came out, and he framed it, and it was in his house. And when he died a few years ago, my stepmother sent it back to me, because if I'd had it, I would have been gone.
Right.
So I was like, I got my out of step from dad's. And of course, it's been in a picture frame with the record in it. And like, so it's got sun damage and it's all wonky.
Warped and dished up.
To be honest, I haven't tried to play the record. I just kept it all together as it came from dad. Well, I took it out of the frame because it was tacky. It was the 80s framing was not really at the, you know, peak of my aesthetic now. But yeah, I should try, actually, after I talk to you, I'll see if it actually plays.
Yeah, I'd love to see a picture of the test pressing if you're able to share that. Because that's a representation not only of your career, but also of your dad as well. So
yeah,
that's very bittersweet.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, you know, this happens, and I'm glad he got to enjoy it. He was proud of it. You know, mm-hmm. It was cool. I mean,
so whenever I look back at the early Minor Threat pictures and whatnot, and I've got a couple of boys, 13 and 15, and I think about what you guys were doing, and perhaps even putting myself in the shoes of your parents and thinking like, oh my God, my kids are 16 and they're getting in a van and God knows where, and there's no way to get a hold of you guys back then. I mean, obviously, you know, mobile phones are way off in the future. How were your parents with you taking on this life at such an early age?
Well, my parents were separated, and my father lived in Atlanta and my mother lived in DC. And so I was, I think, you know, the sort of textbook, I'm going punk. You know, I'm an only child. My parents have split up. Where, you know, did I cause the divorce? You know, all of the things that the stuff that people think. I mean, I wasn't thinking that out loud, but it coincided with my discovery of this music through a school friend. Mm-hmm. And my mother was very, I think in retrospect, dangerously permissive. But at the time, it was kind of, you know, 70s parenting with me. And she just basically let me do what I wanted. And I guess there is a benefit is because I didn't drink or do drugs. And when you, I guess if you think of my mom talking to other friends of hers with a 15 or 16 year old, and they're, I'm constantly picking up the police office, you know, the police department, or I don't know, I found marijuana in his bed, you know, all of the shit. Well, it didn't happen with me. I was this kind of, you know, pretty Ward Cleaver kind of, well, I guess I wasn't the Beaver. I'd be Wally. It's kind of a Wally.
You weren't Wally, Eddie Haskell. You were.
Yeah, no, I was not Eddie Haskell. And so there was some leniency there. And also Ian and Jeff were 18 and she trusted them. And she had a very good instinct because, you know, certainly Jeff and Ian were trustworthy and still are. And I believe, I don't know if this is really true or not. I can't find any paperwork or evidence. And I've talked to Ian about it. And I believe that Ian had to be my guardian. There was some paperwork involved.
He assumed responsibility while you were
to go out of state. When I went on my first Minor Threat tours, I believe that that was the case, but I haven't found any way to prove it. And we both have talked about it and we don't know if it's, I don't know if it's not true. But I don't have any real, I don't know.
It's a fuzzy memory of something, a transaction. Fuzzy memory.
But I think those things were done. I think it was, I mean, if I cared enough to investigate it, but, you know, I've got, I have other things to do. I could find out if it's absolutely true. But my mom, I do know my mom said that. And, you know, she, I don't see why she would lie about it.
Now, you weren't into beers, you weren't into pot or anything like that. There was no interest at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't, coming into discovering punk rock, I hadn't ever drank or took drugs because I was so young and so sort of undeveloped socially in that way that I didn't go to parties where people's parents weren't home and everyone raided the liquor cabinet. I just didn't really have that access. And I didn't think about it that much. I was into playing guitar. I played a lot of guitar and I skateboarded and I rode BMX bikes. And like, that was my 14, 15. So when Minor Threat started, I mean, this, you know, it's obviously the legacy is that it was some sort of straight edge prison or, you know, a juggernaut, a lifestyle choice. It really was just one of our songs, and those guys didn't drink, and I didn't drink. It was like a kind of, I didn't think about it too much.
Yeah,
you know, it just was kind of just how I was. I mean, by the time I was 21, of course, I managed to become a pretty active alcoholic and drug abuser.
You made up for it.
I made up for it. Yeah. Oh well.
Now Jeff and Ian, they were playing together, Teen Idols. How did you get roped into what became Minor Threat?
Well, I went to the same high school that Lyle Pressler went to. Mm-hmm. And Lyle Pressler had been, I guess, picked to be, I don't know how they got word of Lyle, but he was going to be the new guitar player for the new Jeff and Ian band to be determined. Mm-hmm. And the scene was so small that there were probably not very many people to choose from who weren't already involved in a band. And I wasn't in a band, and I was a guitar player, but I was willing to try to play bass because it seemed like I could do it, even though I didn't have one. And so I kind of just got, it was just the luck of that, like I showed up.
Were you kind of active in that budding punk community, or was this kind of new for you?
Well, we were, to be technical, we were third wave if you put Ian and Henry at second wave, because there was a very interesting art. It's kind of hard. I mean, I think Ian and Henry probably count as first wave, but there's we were the little kids. They were 18. They were graduating and graduated high school. We were still in high school. I was in 10th grade. Lyle was in 11th grade, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So we hung out with other people of our age, and that would be Brendan Canty, Michael Hampton, who Brendan, of course, went on to Fugazi and who's in Rites of Spring, Michael Hampton from SOA. Michael Hampton went to my high school. Johnny Temple from Soulside and Girls Against Boys went to my high school. Guys from Iron Cross went to my high school, the two little guys, Dante and Mark. So we hung in our, you know, we don't have driver's license crew, the bus crew. And so we went to all the, you know, we went to the shows, but still there was definitely a delineation, you know, between the grown-up people and the
There's
people
a
who are
big difference between 16 and 18.
Huge. Absolutely. Yeah. And I was incredibly small for my age. I was barely pubescent. I was like 5'1", I think, when I first started playing with Minor Threat. The bass just was like, you know, it's as big as I was.
Was it full scale or a three quarter?
Yeah, it was Ian's bass from Teen Idols, because I didn't have a bass. And it was an Ibanez copy of a Fender Jazz bass.
Okay.
And it only had three strings on it because the tuning peg had broken in Teen Idols, I suppose. So Ian just took off the bridge, the corresponding string parts. And so the Minor Threat bass was three strings for the first, I don't know, until I got a bass much, I might have done the first demo with a three string bass. I mean, not like you really needed the four string, but you see the, you get it. It's a good, it shows how serious we were about our gear.
So what came first, the band name Minor Threat or the song Minor Threat?
I don't know. I think maybe they came at the same time. I don't know.
Okay.
But Minor Threat, the song, was one of the first songs. So it goes, I would think it would be logical that Ian would have said, I have this song. It's called Minor Threat. What do you think? What do you think about band? You know, I wish I'd known that anybody would have given a shit. I would have tried to remember some of this. But this is my high school band and I'm a teenager. And like, I say, oh, I have to go to practice. Fuck, I was going to go skate with those guys, you know, in Rockville, whatever. It's like, fuck, practice. And we're talking about Minor Threat. And I'm like, trying to get out of it.
Does it kind of trip you that so many years later, people are obsessed about this period of your life?
I'm just so glad that they are. Wow. I mean, what would happen? What would I have become had I not happened to be in the right place at the right time? You know, with a funny haircut, because that's really it. I didn't even try out, by the way. It was just like, oh, he can play guitar.
You're in.
Oh, good. Yeah, you're in. Okay. Yes,
so,
sir.
So the name Minor Threat was there from the very beginning. There wasn't a battering around of different names. It was already established by the time you got involved.
I think it was established as it was going to be the name. And I know that there was some point very early on that we were like, well, that name might be kind of dumb. We're going to change our name to Fifth Column, which I didn't even know what that meant. And I'm still rough on the details. I think it's a sort of subversive World War II reference to some sort of, you know, spy community or, under, you know, as people who come in and undermine the enemy. And that lasted for one show. And then we were Minor Threat again. I know we played one show where Ian was like, we're changing our name. Our name is Fifth Column. And I think Jeff had written some kind of cool logo for that. But you're not going to believe this one. I didn't realize that Minor Threat meant underage threat for years. I just thought it was Little Threat. I'm not kidding. I didn't understand what it was until probably 82, right?
Really?
Or 80. Yeah. And because I'm not a lyric guy, I never knew what he was singing. Like I'm a melody guy. Like I still don't know what words are for the most part. Like my brain doesn't do words the same way.
Yeah.
And I never really put two and two together in a aha moment until the band had probably until after we had put out the first record.
You were focused on the music. You stayed in your lane.
I just didn't really think about it. And it's like, well, Minor Threat's kind of cool. Like it's because we actually are a big threat. You know, tongue in cheek. I don't know what I was thinking. I was high on Coca-Cola. I mean, I drank 30 Cokes a day. God knows what was going on. Writing lists and calling people who don't remember me. You know?
How long did you guys rehearse before recording that first EP?
We rehearsed after school. I don't really have a great timeline for that. I mean, we would rehearse. I think we rehearsed a couple times a week. Mm-hmm. If I had a piece of paper showing the shows we played, I'm sure that I would have a better way to describe what it was. But I think I know that if we had a show coming up, we would have probably rehearsed. The frequency of rehearsal would go up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, it's something that was such another thing a kid does, you know, with no real concept of this having any impact or relevance in the future. It was approached that way. Maybe that's part of why it's still good, that naivete. It is, if nothing else, it is real and it's not contrived and it's original, you know. So maybe that's my not really keeping track of what's going on was part of it.
From the early days, I should probably say from the early moments of the band, was it always a plan to record and release an EP, put it on a record?
Yeah, because that was the Discord. I didn't realize this until I was probably 40, which is telling. But Discord, in Ian's vision, Discord was like a community service. It wasn't, I mean, it was more, it was a nonprofit and it was an archive of music. That's how he thought about it. And so the way Discord started, of course, is that they collected enough money from the Teen Idols to make a Teen Idols record. And then they put the profit from that into the SOA record. And then the profit from the SOA record was the Minor Threat record. And then onto Government Issue. It was never about making any money. It was being able to continue to archive this process and provide this community service, which I think is cool as hell. And, you know, I just wasn't paying enough attention to that. Like, I didn't realize that that was really the goal. I mean, we always wanted to make a record because it's fun and it's interesting to do so. And we want people to hear us, but it was never with the idea of like, and then we can become more popular.
Right. Then we can get spandex.
Yeah, now we'll get signed. Well, no, we didn't even know what that was.
Right.
So that's how.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I get that the motivation was to capture the moment. And I mean, what better people than Ian and Henry? I mean, they seem to have a real knack for documentation, almost an archivist mentality. Any idea where they learned that? Is that what their parents did? Were they involved in that at all?
I don't know. I don't know anything about Henry's parents, but Ian's, Ian's parents were journalist, newspaper, you know, that written word.
Yeah.
People. So, you know, this would be a much better interview if you were talking to Ian, because he knows everything. He remembers. I mean, he remembers everything very clearly. He has a great mind. And oftentimes I've done interviews where I've, even when you can see me, and I've just picked up my phone and texted, like, could you please tell me what the fuck we did in 1983? Because I have no idea. So it's I apologize for being a little wild and loose.
You apologize for not being Ian. Is that what?
Well, you know, we all should. Come on. It's an impossible standard to meet.
I know. All these years, he's continued to hold that bar very high.
Oh, God. Yeah, because he's not full of shit. It's amazing. Yeah. He's actually just a really nice person who's smart and that believes in things. Like
He may be one of a handful of people on Earth that's not full of shit.
I know. It is a privilege to still be friends with him. I have to I enjoy it very much.
So when you went to record that first EP, did you feel prepared? Do you recall being prepared, or do you recall anxiety? What are your memories of that?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. So when you went to record that first EP, did you feel prepared? Do you recall being prepared, or do you recall anxiety? What are your memories of that?
I don't recall being anxious. I think we were well rehearsed. The first thing we recorded actually was the first demo, which for all intents and purposes was pretty much the same as the single that we recorded. I think we went in to record a demo and not something to put out, or maybe we had some free, you need to call the big guy, because it could have been that we were helping Don test out equipment. I mean, I know I've done projects at Inner Ear in the early days where he got some new piece of equipment and needed people to be in the room so he could figure out, you know, like, I want to try out my new tape machine, you know, because this was a local guy, part of our world, and just happened to be an excellent hobbyist and audio engineer. I don't know if we went in to make the single and then we didn't think it was good enough, so we redid it, which doesn't make sense because I think the demo in many ways is stronger than the single itself. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I know that I was not freaked out, and it was fun. I mean, the recording process was very interesting, and it was great to get into. I mean, this was, you know, the closest thing to a real studio I'd ever been in.
Now, at the time of recording that first EP, did you have the songs or some of the songs from In My Eyes or later in the catalog prepared then? Or did you record everything you had at the moment?
My sense is that we recorded everything we had at the moment.
Okay.
I believe so.
We call that first EP Filler. Was it known as Filler to the band, or it was just Minor Threat?
Okay. It was Minor Threat, the red Minor Threat single, right. Or EP, but Minor Threat EP. We didn't call it Filler.
Okay. Do you recall anything about how quickly that first version sold out? Were you surprised about that?
I know that it sold out quickly and everyone was very excited about it. And I know that I didn't live at the Discord House. So, you know, at this point, Discord House is the group house where Ian and Jeff live, and many, many other people in the scene have gone in and out of it. I don't know who actually was on staff when that record was released, but, I don't even know if they had the Discord House then. They must have. Whatever the case, I wasn't really, you know, I wasn't on top of that. I wasn't.
Okay.
What are the numbers, gentlemen? Hi. Hi, it's Brian. No, I'm sorry. My management needs to know what kind of.
What's your projection for Q2?
Yeah, exactly. How are we doing? Are you going to pay quarterly? Is it quarterly you guys run on? Because, you know, actually monthly is good for me. So no, but I know that it was really well. It was well received. And I sold them at school. Like, I would take some to school and sell them to seniors and people mm-hmm. who weren't punk. And I remember that people who didn't look punk or were just, you know, older, so I didn't really have a relationship with them, would come back to me and say, that's a really cool record. I really like this, but I've never heard anything like this. And that was nice. Mm-hmm. You know?
And so they were sold through mail order. Sounds like you guys sold some at shows, some privately, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we would sell them wherever we could. But we, you know, I think we sold them at Yesterday and Today Records, our record store that Skip Groff owned. And I think they were at local record stores. I think it's safe to say that they would be available at whatever local record stores were extant. Mm-hmm.
Now, were you part of the folding parties, you know, where everyone got together? Okay. All right. What are your memories of that?
It you know, it was, we had a lot to do. And I just remember having a big, huge, like, how the fuck am I going to get through all these records? Everybody had a stack, because when you think about it, like, I don't know what the first pressing was. Let's say it was 500. I don't know. Was it?
I think it was 1,000.
Okay. 1,000 record sleeves is a daunting evening. And there's a lot of folding, and then with the Yoo-Hoo stick, and this stick doesn't work, and what's that going to be? And then there's Jeff and me. I don't know. I think all of us probably, like, every certain amount, you get bored and write something in it. You know, a little Easter egg, which with the time we weren't thinking about it that way, because you think you're writing something that's underneath the glue flap that no one will ever see.
Little did you know that decades later, maniacs are pulling them apart.
Or that the fucking Yoo-Hoo glue stick just didn't hold. Okay. Like, you know, I'm sure that's how people first found out something written in there. And so, yeah, it was just, I remember just hanging out around a big table and everybody doing that.
Mm-hmm. Now, everyone had their job. Was it like an assembly line, or here's 25 records, you do them from beginning to end?
I think everyone did them individually, but there were other friends helping too. It wasn't just band members at all. Yeah, it was just the, you know, whoever was at the house, whoever was hanging.
It seems like that first EP, it went way beyond everyone's expectations. Do you recall what the expectations were, and just everyone just being flummoxed about all this demand for it? Because I think it was repressed 4,000 units within the first year.
I think that everyone wanted it to just continue to make enough money to fund other records, and it certainly did. And I can't tell. It would be very Jeff-like that it was like a hassle to keep making more. But on the other hand, the idea of how do you change it, and you know, I don't know who thought of changing the colors like that. And what happened with that, you know, because I wasn't in the production part of it, but I think everyone was pretty happy about the fact that people wanted this record. And I'm sure that that went to prop to write directly to for Discords 5, 6, 7, and 8. It just was giving you more cash to put out other local bands.
Right. So, yeah. The next few releases sorted. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That was the goal.
And how long after that first EP was In My Eyes recorded? It's within the same calendar year, I believe. Yeah,
I don't know. I don't remember if In My Eyes was recorded because Lyle was going to college. We were breaking up. I don't know if that's why we did it then. That's a theory. You'd have to call again. You got to call the hotline. 243-2454-703 area. Yeah, I wish I could be, I wish I knew exactly, but I'm just bad with the timeline, but my sense is that's what happened within my eyes. Because the idea, again, was to archive and to get this stuff down. And that's why the Salad Days record was recorded posthumously. It's like, so that stuff got recorded and that we had it, even if the band was no longer together.
Right. Because you guys stopped playing shows after 82, yeah?
Well, we stopped for Lyle to go to Northwestern, and then he came back because he went for a semester, I believe, and then decided he didn't want to go to Northwestern University in Chicago, and it was cold. And so he came home, and we decided to start the band up again. So that was when that period, that's why we wouldn't have been playing shows, is because we didn't have a guitar player. I mean, and we all did different things. I joined Government Issue, and I think maybe that was Skewbald era for. I mean, you know, we just...
Everyone's kind of splintered.
There's a lot of musical chairs in the DC hardcore world. You know, like, okay, well, we're going to break up and we're going to reform with almost all the same people and call it something different. That happened a lot. Hire from within.
So one person in one of those musical chairs is Tesco V.
Yeah.
To the point where he was around so much, he received a thank you on In My Eyes. So he was a character that was in the close circles. You ended up joining the Meat Men for a little while. How did that happen?
Well, it was, Tesco, we met Tesco when he was still living in Michigan, and through, he was kind of when we discovered the Necros and Negative Approach and Tesco. So we became friends with him. We stayed at his house when we were on the road, and then he moved to DC. So when you see that, like, he quickly decided, like, I want to be part of this. I don't want to sit in. I don't remember if he was in Lansing. He was somewhere that was not particularly hot. I don't recall what it was at the time. Actually, Lansing might have been really cool. Maybe it's further out than that. And so he moved. So he became part of the DC community really quickly. So that thank you was probably when he was like, you know, or maybe he was. God, I wish I knew. You know, he did something great for somebody. He was a nice man.
I see Jell-O's also noted on that. Do you recall what Jell-O's contribution was?
Jell-O took us in San Francisco. I mean, I think that Jell-O is, when we first went out there, he's the guy who arranged for us to play, and we stayed at his house and he showed us San Francisco. And I remember riding a very distinct memory, just riding around with him in this old Mercedes and going to get burritos at La Cumbre and the Mission. And I would go back to La Cumbre every single chance. I mean, for the next 40 years, I would go back to La Cumbre because of that, you know. So he was, I'm sure he was just another benefactor, someone who was very helpful to us, or a booster. Got it. And Jell-O would have been like a rock star to us, because he was in a California band that we'd heard of and we'd had his records. And, you know, it was really, think about it. That's what it would have been for us. To answer the Meatmen question quickly, it was because I wanted to hang. It was, Meatmen was always kind of a fun side gig. And we had recorded, Lyle and I and Ian and maybe Rich Moore, we had done an EP, a Dutch Hercules EP, which was a solo record that Tesco did outside of the Meatmen. Mm-hmm. And so when he was reforming the Meatmen in DC, when he moved here, it was kind of already going to be a cast of characters. And so I just played because I didn't have really much else to do. Like, oh, yeah, I'll play with you. This will be fun. And we just kind of, you know, it was a semi-permanent gig. Like, it wasn't ever, it, well, the band is performance art. It's not a joke band, but it's really Tesco's performance art. You know, it's not.
It's cabaret.
Yeah, exactly. So we were just hanging out with Tesco, you know, like, yeah, I'll play on your record. That sounds fun. And I was best friend with the bass player. So
did you tour War of the Superbikes?
I played shows out of the city, but I never went on a tour, a proper tour in the sense. Mm-hmm. I don't recall being in a van for any extended period of time.
Okay. So you had connections in California to San Francisco with Jell-O.
Right.
Was Bad Religion on your radar at all at this time?
No, not at all. The only thing I knew about Bad Religion is they were on some flyers. And when we went on tour, I don't know if all of us did. I know I wound up with a bunch of flyers from shows that we weren't on just because they're cool. There's evidence of punk right here in my hand. Even though it was 2 weeks ago, I have it. Sin 34 played with Bad Religion somewhere. You know, mm-hmm. So the flyers themselves were things that we would keep and so I saw Bad Religion's name, but I was not, they were not on my radar, Minor Threat radar. And they were, we never saw them actually
mm-hmm.
back in the day.
Okay. When did they first come on your radar? Do you have a memory of, like, okay, here's the music of them?
I came in so late. They came in on my radar precisely when the record Recipe for Hate came out on Epitaph, 1993, if I'm not mistaken. And I was dating a woman who worked at Epitaph, and she had a pre-release cassette of this album. And I had it, and I had it in my car stereo, and it stuck in the stereo. It couldn't be ejected. And it was a great thing because I thought it was just the most amazing record that I had heard in years and years. And I distinctly remember saying, I'm such a fucking idiot. If I had not fucked up Dag Nasty, we could be a band as good as this. I probably said it out loud driving my car. And so I was just blown away by Recipe for Hate. And I had never heard the other stuff. I had to go back and investigate. But I really didn't do that until I, you know, the time frame was such that I wound up being in the band pretty quickly. And my methodology
Oh, okay.
was that I knew both guitar players in the band socially. And so each guitar player, I would tell, hey, when your other guy leaves, call me. And then I'd go to the other guy and say, hey, when your guy leaves, call me. So I had my bases covered and one of them left.
It was just a waiting game at that point.
From Hudson. That was it. I'd done the groundwork. I'd laid it in there. And that's basically what happened. And I got that gig. And, you know, then I heard Suffer and No Control. And all of that. Now, I will say it's not quite that good. We did have a copy of How Could Hell Be Any Worse. I had a copy of that, or a friend of mine had one, because I remember listening to that and liking it. Because I liked Graffin put piano in on some songs, and I thought his voice was really good. It was, I think my recollection was that the voice was great, but the band was kind of sloppy, is what I thought.
Okay.
Yeah, but it was around. It was just I've heard Bad Religion. This is what it sounds like.
So when you joined Bad Religion, that was the time where they were transitioning to Atlantic. Is that right?
They were already
Gray Race?
They were on Atlantic. No, I joined. Brett quit after they had recorded Stranger Than Fiction, but before it was released. So I joined the band in order to tour and perform, you know, from that point for Stranger Than Fiction. I mean, I joined, we have to get a guitar player right now. And I was standing there.
Was it awkward with Brett? Because, I mean, he's exiting, you're entering.
No, because Brett and I were cool because he had put out a Dag Nasty record in 91.
Okay.
And also, as I said, I'd been dating this woman who worked at Epitaph. And Epitaph was a small building, you know. Mm-hmm. And I kind of knew Jay Bentley worked there. And I knew him a little bit. But, yeah, I was cool with Brett. And you know, I was kind of like, I was warm water between the visionaries, you know. Classic fucking...
So when you joined, you'd had a choice at this point. You'd already had a deal to tour with REM.
Yes.
Okay.
But that was as a touring musician, I don't remember who, I think I might've been Peter Holsapple who was performing that job. I don't remember who in their entourage, they've always had, you know, cause they were so huge. They'd all long since had people helping out.
Mm-hmm.
And they just needed somebody for the Monster Tour that they were about to go on. And I got the gig. And so I was going to go do that. But it was a sideman job and an awesome one. And I was, you know, I was certainly a huge REM fan. It was kind of a bit of a tough choice, but they were really cool about it. And I introduced them to the person that they took in my stead. You know, I have a guy, he's actually better than me, but I wouldn't have told you that until now. And he got the job, so it worked out for everybody.
What's interesting about, especially you know, in Minor Threat and in Bad Religion, you've played this very pivotal role alongside the songwriters. You know, working with Jeff and Ian in Minor Threat, and then you know Brett and Greg in Bad Religion. Yeah. How do you keep that balance and contribute while also helping those songwriters kind of realize that vision they come to the band with?
Well, it's easy. I write lots of songs, but I don't write words. So I am a riff machine. I can riff all day, but I bring parts and then the smart people put them together and make them into songs. I mean, that's really the simplest way to describe it. My contribution, Minor Threat contributions were just musical. Mm-hmm. As you may not be surprised by at this point in the interview, I don't really remember which ones I'm credited on writing in Minor Threat,
mm-hmm.
but I know it was a couple. And
yeah.
So that would have been me having the music. And definitely when I came into Bad Religion, you know, those guys were songwriters who worked independently and created music and lyrics, whole songs. And then they'd get together and decide, you know, if one guy has 10, one guy has 10, we only need 15, which ones do we keep? I did not come in to replace, to be Brett Gurewitz, because that wasn't what I could do. What I did do was just collaborate with Greg. And so I would write music and then he would hear something, go like, oh, that part's great. Do that again. Okay. I have an idea for lyrics. That's how I've just been collaborative. I haven't really, the only time I've ever really brought in whole songs was in Dag Nasty. And that was early on when there really wasn't a singer. We didn't know who was going to sing. So I had to do something.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as we had people writing lyrics, I didn't write lyrics anymore. I just went back to making the music.
Do you miss writing lyrics?
No, I wasn't very good at it. I mean, some of the stuff, I don't know. I just don't, I'm a little more private. I don't really need to vomit out my feelings so directly, I think. You know, this, I have a therapist, so. My dream gig is the fifth guitar player in Iron Maiden, just grinding out those, grinding out, just playing those chords, not having to sing, just hanging out right in front of a mark.
Do you have any guilty pleasure music? I mean, Iron Maiden sounds like
that's not a guilty pleasure. That's a smart person liking great British fucking heavy metal. Yeah. I don't have a lot of guilty pleasure. There's stuff that people are surprised that I like. I like TLC. That's one of my favorite sort of.
Don't Go Chasing Waterfalls. Yeah, TLC.
Yeah, okay. I will tear up to Waterfalls if it's the right time of the day. You know, but in general, no, there's nothing guilty. I mean, I just like, like many people of my age, I like music made by people who were really into the Beatles when they were young, mm-hmm. and the Beatles too. So, you know, that explains XTC, and that explains The Damned, and that explains all of these things that were so important to me learning to be a musician. It's all Beatle freaks making their own versions of it when, you know, that I have to be able to look back and see where it all came from.
Well, they did write the rule book. So were they a primary influence? Who was the band that got you to think, let's pick up the guitar. I want to participate. That's the Beatles.
Oh, yeah, it was the Beatles. I got the first song I learned to play was Yellow Submarine. And I got a Beatles song book for Christmas when I got my first guitar when I was 7 going on 8. I was going to turn 8 in February. And so I had started raising hell, Bart Simpson style. Give me a guitar. I want a guitar. Give me a guitar. I've been doing that, I assume, since, you know, for months. And so they finally broke down. And I think it was like a rent to buy. So they were hedging their bets. I didn't want to go all in on the guitar. But yeah, that was the thing. It was the Beatles. And then after Revolver is the one where I really... Taxman was the first thing where I was like, Jesus Christ, like George Harrison is it. It was single notes. The first single note stuff I learned, the first lead stuff I learned, all was from Revolver. And George and I share a birthday. So it had to be. It was meant to be. February 25th, people, you know. and that was, yeah, it was Beatles. That's where it really started. And then on top of that is AC/DC. You know, I had my parents, my father worked at a television station where they got free records. They would send, you know, as they did back in the day, you'd get promos of everything. I guess maybe for whatever reason, because they wanted to give them to the CBS affiliate in Washington, D.C. And so I got records that I would never have known about or found. And my were cool enough where they would, you know, they'd have a few drinks and dance around Elton John or, you know, little Stones, you know, some Akadeka. They liked it. It was cool. I love that.
So would you gravitate more towards Malcolm or Angus?
It's great because they're both so different and so important. And my lead playing is Angus, but hopefully my rhythm playing is Malcolm. As close as, I mean, you can never attain.
That's that. Another high bar.
But Malcolm Young, in my opinion, was the greatest rock and roll rhythm guitar player ever, ever to exist. Without any, no one's even close to him. Actually, I have a Malcolm Young tattoo. Oh, wait. I guess the listeners can't see it, but I have a Malcolm Young tattoo.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That I got. It was after he died. And at his funeral, they were giving out picks, memorial picks that had MY with the lightning bolt between them written in that font. Right. And I saw one of these memorial picks on a site somewhere, and I was like, God, that was such a thoughtful, what a great thing to give to people who came to the, you know, the family came to the service. And I was like, that would be cool if I just got a tattoo of that, even though they didn't invite me to the service.
Oh, you weren't that, I was at the service.
Well, yeah, I'm a random American. They don't, oh. No one, you have access.
I could have got you in.
No, no. This is the kind of thing you want to try to make them be like, let me into your funeral, please. Yeah. I don't know.
Can I get a plus one?
It doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel right to me. Well, then you saw the pick, right? If you went
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's the program. Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. So that was it. Yeah. They're both so different, but, and Malcolm was definitely my biggest solo influence. And then what you hear now from me is Captain Sensible from the mm-hmm. Dance, Paul Fox from the Ruts, and Malcolm Young. And if you can combine all that in a blender, but the blender is owned by Billy Gibbons. It's his blender. And that stuff is in it. And then you have your drink, and then at the very top, there's a little foam, and that's Discharge and GBH. I don't know what the foam is, but that's really, it's the best I can do. There's some Discharge in there too. It's fucking crazy. I don't know.
So there's this story that I hear about you getting on stage with Carlos Santana at age 12.
True.
How did that happen?
We'll be back after these messages.
Psst. Well, hey everyone, it's Nate here. Rather than running our sponsor ads again, can I give a plug for our Patreon page here? Patreon.com/finalguide, where right now there is an extended interview and it's totally commercial free. And quite frankly, you know, I'm sure you all know podcasts only really exist because of the support of the audience. And that's what I'm here to ask you for. Please consider supporting the show, $5 or 10 bucks a month, whatever you can afford. Because if you're listening to this now, some into the episode, that's great. You're enjoying it. I'm glad you're enjoying it. For that, I would ask you to please consider supporting the show. Patreon.com/vinylguide. It's super important. It's like a direct lifeline to us here, and it's a huge signal, and the support is so welcome and helps keep this podcast going. Each week, I put extra stuff up there, extended interviews, and it's all ad-free, and it's early, and it's all that kind of stuff. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask you politely, please, support the Vinyl Guide, patreon.com/vinylguide. All right, that's it. Back to the show. No limits.
So there's this story that I hear about you getting on stage with Carlos Santana at age 12.
True.
How did that happen?
I was in a cover band at my school. I lived briefly in Michigan. My parents were together still, and we had to move to Michigan because my dad got a better job at a different television station. Mm-hmm. And so we moved to Michigan, and I went to a new school. And in that school, I met musicians, and we formed a cover band. And I remember we played like Cheap Trick. I think we played a Sex Pistols song, but that's funny because I didn't really even know what that was at the time. But, you know, the general, like, you know, junior high school cover band from 1978. Mm-hmm. The drummer's dad owned a restaurant in Detroit that the Santana people had been going to every year when they came to tour. And so everyone was friends. And this is, I mean, I understand this in Bad Religion. There's restaurants that we go to. It's like, yeah, my God, I'm so glad to see you kind of things. And what happened was the tour manager gave our drummer's father some backstage passes for us to go to the show. And we went to the show, and we were being led around the labyrinth of whatever venue this was. I still don't know if it was, I keep thinking it's Cobo Hall, but I think it might've been a different venue, but still, you know, to me, an enormo dome, like some crazy, unfathomably hard.
It was 10,000 people.
And they opened a door to a tuning room, and there were maybe 10 guitars on stands, and I don't know protocol, and I walk right up and start playing. I just pick one off the stand and start playing it, and no one takes it from me. And I think it's kind of, you know, I think someone else came, maybe the guitar tech came and looked at me, and no one stopped me. And I played for a little bit until I realized, like, I'm sitting on the ground playing a guitar in front of these people who want to go continue the tour. Mm-hmm. And so I put the guitar back and we kept going. But I guess that's what let them know I could play, because at the end of the show, I'm on the side of the stage by the monitor desk, and I see the drummer, Billy Muir, being led up to the bongos on stage. And I'm going like, how can he be on stage? He can't be up there. You can't go up there. What the hell is that? And as I'm freaking out, a guy's approaching me with a guitar, and he puts a guitar on me and leads me out and plugs me into a 112 Mesa Boogie Come. And now I'm on stage. And then it's just, you know, I mean, I have photographs, so I remember it because of the photographs.
Right. But
I remember it just being overwhelming and cool and kind of dreamlike. It was like a dream state.
Did it feel natural? Like, I mean, you going out in front of 10,000 plus people, that's got to be pretty
intimidating. You can't see the people, right? Because you're on a lit up stage. And this is still to this day when I play these big festivals, they're like, don't you freak out? It's like, I don't have my glasses on. I can't see anybody. I see the back of a security guard, maybe. So it wasn't really that. It was just the energy and the heat, I know, was big. But I also knew that I knew how to play guitar enough. Like, I was like, I think there was some communication in which I wanted to know what they were going to play, what key it was in. And Carlos Santana wanted to know who I was and what my name was, because I don't know how much information he had before this 4'6" guy with like a bowl cut and fry boots comes waddling out on the stage with a Les Paul. And he asked me my name. And then he goes to the microphone, is holding my arm up and says, this is my new friend, Brian. And we're playing. And then we play a song. And I don't know what it is, but I like to think it's Black Magic Woman because it's an encore. And it, I think the key was in G. I don't know. But I know for the story, I like to say it's that. I don't know what it was. And I know that I traded solos. And you know, it was just crazy that this whole thing was happening. And, you know, I mean, I was still not, let's put it this way. I was better then than I am now. Like, I got good really quick. I was at guitar and then I plateaued instantly. So probably on the way home from the Santana gig, that was it. So I was, for my size and age, I was unusually able, you know, to be able to play, like, you know, blues shit in the key of G. Like, I could do that. I could play Chuck Berry stuff and whatever was required of me, I guess, that night. And you know, I would not have believed it if there had not been a couple of photographers there who were smart enough to take a bunch of pictures and then sell the pictures to my parents. I don't know how they found my parents, but my parents were very eager to buy these pictures. And the other confirmation is that I found out many years later that John Brannon from Negative Approach was at the show and saw me doing it. And so when I met John Brannon at a Negative Approach show in 1981, you know, or whenever, I don't remember when he told me, but it's like, you were the kid on stage. I was really high. So he was like on acid and couldn't believe there was some kid on stage. That was you? It's like, yeah. So it has to be true because he saw it.
They should have brought him up and let him do some vocals.
Wouldn't that have been great? God, that would have been great.
So I would imagine that's somewhere on a bootleg.
You know, I'm sure that if you went deep, you would think it would be. I don't know. I do know that this story, I told this story to a journalist about 2 years ago, and I don't recall which magazine it was for, but I got a DM from the current guitar tech for Santana, who loved the story and said that anytime that they're playing, that please hit him up and they would love to have me come and see the show. And I don't think he specifically said jam with the boys, but, you know, it was very kind of him. And I intend to do that the next time that I'm in the same place as that group. I will definitely hit this guy up for sure.
All right. So we've got an assignment for our listeners here. We need to find this bootleg. We need to find a recording of this somehow.
Yeah, we do. And it would help if I knew the exact date.
Well, we kind of know, we know the year. You were 12.
It's 1970. I believe it was 78.
78.
I used to have I had a sticky pass from it, but okay. I don't know what it is.
That's all right. 1978. It was in Detroit.
Detroit, 1978. When I was trying to figure out when it was, I'd always thought it was Cobo Hall, but I think it was another venue, and I just can't remember the name of it right now. But anybody who understands, yes, they'll know this. That yeah. Find the bootleg with the weird, like sort of out of tune guitar out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. That would be very cool to hear that if it exists.
Have you tried asking Ian? He seems to know a lot.
You know, he doesn't. He's not as up on his Santana as would hope. And that's crazy. I mean, I assume that he would have, you know, oh, well, that was January 17th. You remember?
Yeah.
At least the cult open. Don't you remember? Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Well, look, Brian, thank you very much for spending time with us.
It's a pleasure.
You know, I want to be respectful of your schedule, and I know there's a lot to get to. Well, real quick, before you go, what's next for Bad Religion? What's next on the calendar?
Well, we have a number of festival shows in the United States mm-hmm. coming to end out this year. I'm many, many weekends from now through December. We have a trip to Japan in March, the end of March. And we are going, oh, you know what's so funny? We're going to Australia. And
right.
You know what? It's great because we're going to Australia. We're going with some friends, and I believe it's a co-headlining tour. I don't know if you've heard of a band called Social Distortion. Yeah. So we're going, Social D and us are coming, and everybody's excited. And I've already worked out a plan with Johnny Two Bags and he's not going to tell Mike, and I'm just going to all of a sudden be playing, like, you know, Don't Drag Me Down and just not tell him. And then Johnny's going to go out and not tell Graffin and, you know, play American Jesus. I mean, it'll be too late to stop it once they notice. 2023, definitely. We are going to be there and New Zealand with Social Distortion.
Wonderful. Well, I can't wait for that. All right. Great. Anything else you'd like to share or make sure everyone's aware of?
Well, you know, yeah, I have a couple of records that aren't Bad Religion related that are out okay. right now. Currently out right now is a band called The Beach Rats, and it is a New Jersey hardcore record. It's on Epitaph. And it features myself and Pete and Brian from the Bouncing Souls. And the singer is Ari from the band Lifetime. And I think it's an excellent record. And it is, you know, it is my local band. When I moved to New Jersey, I moved to the town where these guys live. And we live, you know, within a mile of each other. And we just started, we made this fun hardcore band. And our whole goal was no shows. It's basements or festivals, like no in between. Like, we don't want to go, you know, none of that. Like, I just want festivals and basements. And so far we've played a couple basements and we played Riot Fest a few years ago. So our dreams have come true, but a new record that we wrote and recorded during lockdown is out now on Epitaph. And if that weren't enough, which it really should be, there is another record coming out by my other band called Fake Names. And Fake Names, we released a record in May of 2021. And Fake Names features myself and Dennis Lixon from Refused, Michael Hampton from Embrace and SOA, and Johnny Temple from Soulside and Girls Against Boys. And we now have a new drummer, and his name is Brendan Canty, who was in a few bands in DC that you might have heard of. So there is a new Fake Names album, and it is called Expendables. It has been recorded. It is in the queue for vinyl, which takes a long time, but it looks like it's going to be a March 2023 release for the new Fake Names album. And I'm very proud of it. Brendan is really amazing. And it was really great to get to play with Brendan, you know, because we all played together when we were infants. But now, you know, it's we're in our, you know, middle and late 50s. And to have that same fun as a, you know, proto senior is just fucking fantastic. It's really been great. And I hope people like the record. I'm very proud of it.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to put links to both these bands and any current releases, especially vinyl ones, in this episode page. People can check them out. I believe they should probably also be on streaming, so you could check them out immediately and probably, you know, get the vinyl.
The Beach Rats and the all of the Fake Names first album, and we have an EP, are all out there streaming too. Right. So if you want to catch up on the Fake Names thing.
Excellent. Brian, again, thank you so much for joining us and answering and being patient through our nerdy questions here.
It's really a pleasure. I really like what you do, and it's fun. I would do this tomorrow if you had more questions.
Well, let's tee up a part two somewhere down the road, or we'll at least see you in Australia, and I'll tell you where to get some of the best Lebanese food you can down here.
That's exactly what I'm looking for. Great. Well, I look forward to it. Nice talking to you.
Take it, Ryan. Cheers.
All right. See you.
Let me tell you, ever since I started this podcast, Brian Baker has been one of those guys where he's been like the top of my wish list. This is a guy I wanted to get on the show for a long, long time. And I'm so pleased when he said yes and made the time and was just ready to talk records. Brian, you are welcome back anytime. And I put some links in this episode page where you can get tickets for the Bad Religion Social Distortion shows, as well as the Fake Names and Beach Rats records. Check out this episode page for more information. And also just a reminder, there is more of this episode up at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, help support the show, and enjoy the extras. And that is it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on social media. Put them on your Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, share with your homies. That is always appreciated. And even leave us a positive review on iTunes. Give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 stars on whatever podcast platform you listen to this on. That is always so appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.